Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Whether you are a first-time gardener or a seasoned veteran, this is a time of year when a lot of questions arise with regard to homegrown flowers, vegetables, and herbs. And of course, there's always the lawn and shrubs to worry about. If you have questions from composting to crabgrass, from azaleas to zinnias, we can help on today's program. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio to help are June Hudson from the Kemper Center for Home Gardening at the Missouri Botanical Garden and her colleague, horticulturalist Elizabeth Spiegel, who is also the chief beekeeper at the garden. We welcome you both. Thanks so much for being with us. I want to get the
Thank
numbers
you.
Out there right away because we always have so many calls. So let me let folks know that you can reach us at 382-TALK. That's 382-8255. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on air, or you can reach us through Facebook. We've got that covered. I hope we get a lot of calls. June, let me begin with you. Well, here we go again with another kind of topsy-turvy spring. It's warm for a day or two, then cold and rainy for a couple of days. What is this doing to the best laid plans for gardening?
As much as we can tell, because it's been almost a pattern of a couple sunny days and then some rainy days and chilly, very chilly. It's been our observation that when the weather is cool, things just sit there. And the minute the sun comes out and warm temperatures return, you can almost stand there and watch things grow. Because this is the time of year they want to grow. You know, they're expecting it to be this way every day. But other than that, you know, I mean, we've noticed that some of the vegetables are slow to come on. And then when they do, they bolt, which means they start to flower, which then makes them not very usable as vegetables. So, you know, they're confused as we are.
That was going to be my next question, Elizabeth. That is, how much damage is being done because we have this erratic weather pattern?
Well, it does seem like things have been really slow to grow, just like June said, and bolting very quickly. Seems like things are flowering before they even get a chance to really reach their full potential.
What does this mean for the home gardener then? What should he or she be doing?
What it's going to mean, and we are thinking about this a lot, is that, you know, summer is, you don't know when summer will kick in, but a lot of times here, it kicks in and never kicks out until fall. So it's a little dubious what to do in the vegetable garden because your spring things may not be done by the time you're used to putting in your summer things like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, beans, you know. You're still going to have some spring vegetables out there. So if you have limited space, you're going to have to bite the bullet, harvest what you can, and then put in your summer things. Otherwise, you're going to be delaying their growth period. So your summer things are going to kick in a lot later, too, or somewhat later, depending on the weather we have then. So we at the garden, you know, we've only got a window to do different seasons. Excuse me. So it looks like maybe we're going to be thinking about taking some things out and starting summer. And if you go to the garden centers, oh, my gosh, they have marigolds since, you know, the end of March. They really push the button. And tomatoes are by the billions. So, you know, people are thinking it's a good time to put those out if they have the room, and soon it will be the best time to put them out.
Well, how do we know what the best time is?
Well, if you're a new gardener, you know, there's many references, but the tomatoes have to have warm temperatures that they get stunted, and that's night temperatures as well. They don't even like it cool at night. Some vegetables can take it a little bit cooler at night, but they all want warm ones during the day. So during those, you know, rainy periods, they just sort of sit there and hope it warms up pretty soon. But how do you know? Well, you know, you get a list, and it has to be a regional list to know every vegetable and when it, you know, it's time to put them out because there is a difference. There really is.
That is an important point, Elizabeth, I think, is knowing what's best to be grown here locally. I think a lot of people probably make a big mistake by trying to grow something that is not going to be really have a friendly environment here.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of, especially spring, because our springs are generally so erratic, a lot of spring vegetables are really hard to do. I find peas to be very difficult because they just don't grow well here because they don't like the heat, and they don't grow well when it's really cloudy and rainy. And so they're a particularly difficult one. But
They yeah. really are. Mm-hmm.
This is a little bit off point, but how do the bees react to a spring like this? Are they confused by it?
Oh, they seem happy. They they really just are waiting for the warm weather to come out and start looking for flowers. On warm, sunny days, they're just all over the outsides of the hives, flying in and out. Yeah.
Well, being over there at the Botanical Garden, they must feel like they're in the Ritz-Carlton when it comes to having things to do and places right. to go and flowers to pollinate.
Yeah, I do think so. Yeah, there's definitely a luxurious amount of flowers for them over there.
I was surprised at that you even had bees over there, but I don't know why I should have been, but it seems to make an awful lot of sense. What about the kinds of equipment that the home gardener, we're talking about someone who's not overly ambitious, maybe has a relatively small garden, what should they have as part of their arsenal of tools?
Oh, well, we know one thing they should have. It's called a Japanese knife, but in many catalogs it's called a hori. And it's like a soil knife. That's what the blade's about, six inches long maybe. And it's serrated on the sides and then comes to a point. It's got, a sturdy handle. We've almost replaced our love for trowels and a lot of other digging tools for this hori because of this pointed end, and you can really dig in. It's pretty ergonomic, It doesn't really hurt your wrist a lot. And if you have hard soil, it really gets in there, where if a trowel is rounded, clunk, clunk, sometimes you just really can't get in there. So the hori is number one. Second to that would be what, a pruner,
Pruners,
Elizabeth?
Definitely.
Yeah, most of the horticulturists have sheaths that hold both. So that tells you that, you want both. But pruner, a good pruner, bypass pruner.
Well, this brings to mind another question, Elizabeth. I'll send it your way. And that is this whole idea of pruning. It seems to me that I've heard probably from June in past programs that there is a right and a wrong time to be pruning anything.
Yeah, definitely. And it definitely depends upon the plant. Many trees like to be pruned in the trees and bushes like to be pruned in the dormant season, and June is really more of an expert on when to prune perennials than I am. Definitely.
Well, and woody things too. I mean, it's even more important with woody things because mm-hmm. if something blooms in the spring and you prune it in the spring, you've just cut off all the ability to have it bloom. But if you wait till the spring blooming plants, shrubs bloom, and then shape them up, then you haven't cut off next year's buds. Hmm. So it's later on things, summer blooming things, that you can cut back in the spring.
What are the biggest mistakes that home gardeners make?
Pruning-wise?
In any area.
Oh gosh. I would say one of the biggest ones is putting things out too early. Mm-hmm. You get so anxious and so worked up, and you want to get out there, and the weather's nice. And a lot of people bring their house plants out much too soon. They really don't want to have night temperatures much under 50. So when you bring them out, you better be prepared to bring them back in again if it's going to be, a period of wet weather or rainy, cold weather.
Do the same rules generally apply with flowers as with vegetables?
Hmm.
In terms of when to put things out and when get started?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. There's spring flowers and there's summer flowers. Mm-hmm. A lot of the summer flowers, some of them, if you put them out in cold soil, they will sit there and pout and maybe not come out of it. So you want to make sure things like pentas and vinca, that you don't put them out until the soil is warm. So we stage, when we put even flowers out, because some things can take it cool and others not at all.
We have a lot of calls, and I want to get to them right away. I just have one or two other questions to get on the table mm-hmm. before we start. And one of them concerns the use of containers. A lot of people, apartment dwellers, condo, what have mm-hmm. you, are turning to container gardening, if you will. What sort of advice, Elizabeth, would you have for these folks?
I grow a lot of things in containers. I think that you can pretty much grow anything if you have the right variety. It's really important to look at the varieties that are available and find ones that are really suitable for containers, maybe even especially bred for container gardening. Especially with things like carrots, if you're trying to do vegetables in containers, carrots, you want shorter carrots for a container. Tomatoes, you probably want a bush variety of a tomato.
You can get pretty ambitious with the containers, I guess, if you're growing carrots and tomatoes and stuff. How big do these containers get? What are some of the various sizes? I mean, that sounds very ambitious to me.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, things, as Elizabeth mentioned, like carrots, you want it more deep than wide, because carrots, anything that has a root that you eat, you're going to have the depth to accompany that. So things that are root vegetables need more depth to the container than width. So, but a tomato, you need a big one, unless you have a really patio tomato. Mm-hmm. You really need tomatoes grow like mad, of course. So they need a...
Maybe yours do. Maybe yours do, yeah. If the critters don't get to them.
Yeah.
Let's go right to the phones. Again, as is always the case, we have so many people who want your advice, both of you. So let's begin with V, who's calling from Old North St. Louis. V, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about asparagus. I planted them about 3 years ago, and I did not harvest them the first year or second year, and now they're coming up, and I don't know if I should cut all of them or let some grow or what to do.
I would say you can definitely start harvesting in your third year. If you find that they're really vigorous, I would go ahead and harvest as needed for your kitchen. However, it is good to let some grow since they're still getting their foothold there.
I didn't know asparagus had feet, Elizabeth.
Well, root. Yeah. Yeah. I think you can definitely start harvesting as needed for the kitchen in your third year.
Asparagus is pretty difficult, isn't it? To grow?
Actually, a lot of people have trouble with it. I think it's related, I don't know, Elizabeth, you might agree or not, but I think it's mostly related to the soil. You know, you have to have good, well-tilled soil, and they love, love, love horse manure.
Mm-hmm.
So get a horse.
This brings to mind another area we should probably discuss before our first break, and that is the soil itself. What people don't know what their soil is. It could be acidic, I guess. It could have any number of attributes, qualities that mm-hmm. are good or not so good for growing. How do we resolve that problem?
Well, we test soil at the garden, and a lot of people bring samples. You need like a full cup at minimally from where you're going to grow whatever you're going to grow, and they ask you on the form what your crop will be. So if the results are really, judged by the crop that you're interested in. So having said that, the results that you get will be appropriate, and they tell you now. It used to be the results were so hard to understand, you had to be a soil scientist to make use of it. But they realize people don't know that, And so they tell you how many pounds of this and how many pounds of that to put in the soil to make it appropriate for the crop you're going to grow.
Can you give me an example of something that just will not grow in a certain type of soil?
You mean vegetable-wise or anything?
Anything,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, sure, blueberries.
Yeah. That was going to be my example.
Elizabeth can talk about blueberries.
Yeah.
They're very specific.
And what mm-hmm. if I want to grow some blueberries, what should I be aware of?
Blueberries really like acidic soil. You can't have your soil too basic, which is really common here because of the limestone in our soil. And a lot of times you have to add peat moss to the soil, which will make it more acidic.
Sulfur.
Sulfur. Mulching with pine mulch also helps. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So am I correct in assuming then that if you've got a soil problem, there's probably a product out there that you can find to correct that problem?
Sure, because most of them are nutrient problems, there's an additive, it's like medicine almost for plants, but there's, nutrients that are out there that are specific to do whatever job you need to do to bring it back into, the right zone to grow whatever.
That's June Hudson from the Missouri Botanical Garden. She's joining me in studio along with her colleague Elizabeth Spiegel, who is also with us in studio. And we are talking about, we're talking about growing things. We're talking about gardening. We're talking about growing flowers. We're going to be talking about lawns. We're going to be talking about whatever questions you have, and we have a bunch of them. So let me take a break now, and then we'll come back and go right to the phones. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7. KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our discussion about gardening. about this time of year and the, some of the problems that this early spring may or may not have created for you on the home gardening front. My guests in studio, June Hudson and Elizabeth Spiegel from the Missouri Botanical Garden. A lot of calls. Let's get right on with it. We'll start with Eric calling from St. Louis. Eric, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I have maybe a kind of a very specific question. I was hoping to do vertical gardening in my backyard since it's a small yard. And I was going to, I was thinking of stringing a rope from a pergola over to the fence, about a 15-foot span, and repeating that throughout the backyard, and then hanging twine down or something to help things grow up along the twine. But then I saw in a book somewhere that I might need to have something stronger spanning that 15-foot gap, like a 2x6, which would make it a lot more complicated for me to do. So I'm wondering what your advice is.
Well, it definitely depends on what you're trying to grow. If you're trying to grow something heavy like gourds or melons, you definitely need a little bit more support. But if it's something like peas, then, you know, you can just have a couple strings and they'll be fine.
I see. Well, what would you say would be the amount of support you'd need if you had something heavy? Let's say you had summer squash or butternut squash.
I would say you'd need probably an extra 2x4 between there, definitely.
Okay.
Is there much vertical gardening going on? I mean, that's a concept I'm not really familiar with.
Well, this is Eric, you've got a really innovative idea there. I was listening in earnest there. That's interesting. Elizabeth comes up with some really innovative ideas, but that's a good one. Vertical gardening is sort of a catch-all term for things that are growing on a flat surface or up. So it can be various things, you know. And so when you listen, that's definitely vertical gardening, but it wasn't what I expected him to say. So having said that, anything that grows is a vine has to have support, obviously. So you can make some pretty interesting selections like that.
This would be something that would be done, I guess, in limited space. I mean, is that why?
Probably, mm-hmm. Yeah. More vertical than horizontal to grow different things. Are you still there, Eric? Is that the case?
Yeah, it's just that I don't have that much space.
Uh-huh.
I had heard about some people somewhere in California that have like only a 30x30-foot backyard or something very tiny who are somehow able to grow all their vegetables for the whole year. I never really checked up on it, but some got word around got about that, and so I wanted to try something similar.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways you can kind of condense your space. There's also the idea of square foot gardening, where you can grow a lot of different vegetables, and each one has its own square foot of space. Kind of increases the different nutrients in the soil and allows each plant to have its own little square, and it allows for a diverse salad for your kitchen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You guys are really going to be put to the test today because we have questions coming from all over,
really?
Including an email from John, who's taking us away from vertical gardens because he wants to know what's the right time of year to trim a boxwood hedge.
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah, well, what we do, we wait till they put on their first flush of new growth. If you do it before then, they're going to put out more growth, and then you're going to end up doing it again in a very short time. So we wait till that first flush of growth has put forth, and then we'll start pruning them because it'll hold it back a lot longer. They'll be much slower to put on some more new growth after that. So we're just getting that growth right now, so it'll be, you know, another, what, 2 or 3 weeks we'll be pruning them.
Okay, John, so hold on to those pruning shears for another couple of weeks, right? Let's take a call from Nicole calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about mulch. I have many garden beds in my yard, and we mulch them every couple of years, do the leaf mulch and then the bark mulch. But my question is, do you remove the old mulch that was there before, or do you just continually leave it and add on to it? Because I do both the leaf and the bark.
I like to
mulching in general, you know?
Yeah, I like to leave my mulch on and usually mix it or till it into the soil, especially leaf mulch. It'll increase the amount of organic matter in your soil, which is a really good thing.
Okay. And if you have, like, I have a lot of, with the weather this spring and just not being able to get out, I have some of these very hefty spring weeds, the ones with the little purple flowers and white flowers and all those, but I know they go away by summer. Should I bother pulling them all out, or you just cut them down and mulch over them?
You could possibly cut them down and mulch over them, but you really want to eliminate their flowers, because then they're going to set seed, and then next year you're going to have zillions more. Okay. So at the very least, you want to cut off the flowers. It's better really to pull them out. Actually, with all this rain we've had, and as big as they are now, they're really easy to pull out. So it's kind of rewarding, you know, if you get out there, you can just lose yourself and pull all these big old weeds out. But as I said, the very least, you need to cut off the flowers.
Okay. And then should you mulch every year, or should you do it heavy enough that you can do it every few years?
Well, it just depends. What do you think, Elizabeth? It depends on how much you got left.
Yeah, and I mean, how many weeds you have popping up throughout the season. I like to lay down a little bit more mulch if I'm getting a lot of weeds. And it also depends on how dry a summer we have. Mulch really works to keep the moisture in the soil. So if it's a dry summer, you might want to add a little bit more.
Is there a rule of thumb with regard to how the depth of mulch over...
3 inches maybe is a good average. What you don't want to do is pile that mulch around the crown of any plant. That's where a lot of people make mistakes. And the crown is really susceptible to a whole bunch of stuff, and you don't want it to rot or get some disease or some critter that goes in there and chomps away on the base of your plant. So when you do mulch, it's a little fussier because you can't just pitch it on. But after you get it all there, you could just pull it back a little bit from all the crowns of the plants. But about 3 inches is the most, you really, don't you think?
Yeah, I would
about
say that's the most.
You know, this is a time of year. I'm sorry?
No, I was going to ask, do you do about 3 inches of leaf mulch and then another 3 inches of bark? Or?
Oh, no, one or the other.
One or
three,
the other.
3 inches altogether.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the call. No, this is time of year when a lot of men in trucks from the country come into the suburbs and try to sell mulch. And I've never been quite sure as to what I'm getting. What is there something I can look for? Again, I'll look for a rule of thumb that makes sure you're getting stuff that's
a sticky wicked question, because you don't really know what's in there. What you don't want them to have done is collect fresh mulch that they've just ground up in some big old grinder, because if you put that on your garden, it may leach the nitrogen away from your plants, and then you end up having to fertilize them. So, but you know, how do you really know that's the case? It's almost a case of, you know, trusting. They've gotten better, really, because a lot of people do that. It's a big industry.
Sure.
But then, you know, how much dead wood is around to call really composted? So it's a matter of trust.
Before I go back to the phones, I've got an email here from Philip I'll read. Is it too late to cut down monkey grass along my entrance walkway? I keep them up all winter to give the yard some shape and green, but it has lots of brown edges now. I didn't have the chance to cut it down in early April as I usually do.
Okay. that's a good question. We deal with a lot of monkey grass. Here's what you got to do. You got to, like, look, separate this monkey grass and look for the brand new shoots. And you can see the brand new shoots coming up out of the old stuff. You either got to cut it a little bit higher than the new growth, because if you don't, you're going to cut the ends of the new growth off, and then you're going to have flat new growth for the rest of the season. So the later you do it, the more likely you are to ruin it for this coming season by cutting off the new growth. So it's a little late now, depending on where this monkey grass is, sun or shade, where you live. But do look for the new growth, and you can only cut right above it.
Okay, I hope that answers the question. I'm sure it did. Let's bring in Art calling from St. Louis, and I think this question is probably going to go to Elizabeth. But go ahead, Art.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Don. You know, I'd like to give you people on your panel a recommendation. The 1956 and 1957 handbook by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, entirely devoted to either the soils or the water, very, very basic. It doesn't get down into the enzymes, the bacteria, the fungi, and the acidomites, but it does tell you the watershed management and how to take care of your soils and all different types of weather conditions. Now, what I'm getting around to is Rachel Carson was probably around when PenCAMBAM came out with respect to the alfalfa weevil, and they started to find it in the brood nest, and then they started to see the heptachlor in the milk coming from the palm fronds that was being fed.
Art, do you have a question, please? I always enjoy talking to you. Let's get right to the point. A lot of calls.
The question is, nicotina pesticides, do you think the two-year experimental that the EU is going to put on them is sufficient enough? And what can the gardeners here in this locale do to caution themselves against any kind of the killing off of their hives?
Yeah, this is a really big big question that a lot of beekeepers are asking right now. There are neonicotinoids, pesticides that have been okayed by the EPA that are now being suspected of killing off honeybees. And the EU has recently banned them. They say they're going to do a two-year study. Now, there have been several studies, most of them conflicting. Recently, a couple of studies have shown that these neonicotinoids are actually killing off the honeybee population. So I think that we'll just have to see what they come up with. And my thoughts are that we should probably avoid using any of them until we know a little bit more about this.
People may not realize just what a significant problem this is with this bee colony collapse, I guess they call it. Our agricultural system in many ways is so totally dependent on these little things.
It really is. And we also have honeybees aren't native here, but we have about 4,000 native varieties of bees. And they are also affected by these pesticides, so we have to think about that too.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go back to the phones, and we'll ask Richard in St. Louis to come on to the discussion. Go ahead, Richard.
Thank you, Don. For your two experts there, my question is, have you in the St. Louis area or in Missouri seen these solar thermal greenhouses where you get solar collectors and they go on the outside, and then on the inside there's a water storage that keeps them very warm in like January and February. And the covering is usually a polymer, one of these high-level polymers like you see when you walk into walk-in refrigerators. You see those big sheets hanging? They're not that expensive, but my question is whether you've seen them any place around the country or in some place in St. Louis.
Yeah, I know that Grower Supply provides those types of greenhouses, and that's where we have gotten a lot of our greenhouse material.
We wish we could get that sophisticated with the solar power, but we don't have the wherewithal to do that. But Elizabeth has managed to raise vegetables in there with a little solar panel that only operates a fan. It's not for heat. These past two winters, so we're learning as we go, you know, what will tolerate cold and what won't. But, gosh, it's a wonderful system if you can get a hold of it. Grower Supply is a great place to look.
It's going to happen more
sure
on
is.
A more widespread basis. Mm-hmm. Justin in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead. You're on the air with our two guests, June and Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm calling just to get a general overview. I can give you a little bit of my specifics, but on the cost-benefit analysis of a Liberty Garden or any type of food-based garden, I have a sufficient amount of land. I brought an 80-year-old gentleman whose farm, a passenger of mine, suggested bringing the soil sample down, did the full workup, found out I'm deficient across the board except for one thing that I'm way too high in. So I had this initial reaction of, oh, this is going to cost a lot of money. I already knew it was going to be a lot of work. And so I'm just curious, you know, as somebody whose main motivations are, I don't like to mow my grass, and so I'd like that ground to be productive. I'd like the free food.
but I'm not overly passionate about gardening or whatnot. Is the cost-benefit analysis, does it work out, in short, for the average person like myself?
Well, in my opinion, you can put in as much money as you'd like. If you want to spend less money and maybe aren't in a huge rush, you can start your own compost pile and add nutrients to your soil that way. And maybe in a couple years after adding compost and mixing it in for a couple years, try get another soil sample and see how you're doing then. But or you can, of course, if you're more motivated and want it to happen a little bit quicker, purchase compost from a company, and then you fix your soil a little bit faster.
There has to be a certain benefit to doing this because it you can put a lot
right.
of money into
it's
it.
It's hard work. There's no doubt, and a passion plays into that a lot, don't you think?
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you have to be motivated to do this. So, yeah, I would say cost effective depends on how many people you're trying to feed with this area. You know, if it's just yourself, it's pretty darn cost effective. But if you've got a fairly good sized family, you have to put a lot of land into production. And, you know, it's always cautious to start slow and see how much you can handle well. And if you still want to do it and you can do more, then you do more. Otherwise, well, maybe not so much.
I have to take a break, but I'm going to get this quick question in an email from Jeannie. I would like to grow rhubarb. What do I need to do to prepare the soil?
Oh, well drained and lots of manure, full sun. And you don't harvest it for, what, two years?
Mm-hmm.
Is it 2 years? Yeah. So, and then you don't cut it off. You can only cut the outer leaves, but I'm sorry, you don't harvest the inner leaves. You only harvest the outer leaves, but you don't cut them. You got to pull them off.
They really like dry soil, too.
And, yes, and they like
so
dry
soil.
They don't
soil. Want too Thanks. Much moisture.
You know, I was growing up, rhubarb was all over the place.
I know.
You know, it just grew wild in lots, vacant
mm-hmm.
lots and what have you. It seemed like it was growing pretty easily.
Yeah, it's not a high maintenance. I don't know if our soil is just, we've had it tested. I'd call in and ask the same question, so we'd know how to do it.
That's June Hudson. She is with me in studio along with her colleague Elizabeth Spiegel, both from the Missouri Botanical Garden. We have to take another break, and we'll come right back to your calls and emails and tweets in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about gardening, spring gardening, summer gardening, and I'm sure we'll probably get to some fall garden questions, too, before all is said and done. My guests in studio are June Hudson and Elizabeth Spiegel, both from the Missouri Botanical Garden. Back to the phones. We have so many callers. Let's bring in Mark from South City. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, I've got a couple questions. First being my zoysia in the front lawn. Something killing it. It's a fungus. So I got something from the nursery, and I'm about to put it down. The other problem is I have a weed issue, and can I do like a weed and feed and this thing I'm doing for the fungal at the same time, or should I wait, or what kind of process am I looking at?
Well, it depends on what the products are, really. It's a kind of a generic question. Do you know the name of the products that you have? A weed and feed, is that like a lawn, like a brand name lawn thing that's got 2,4-D in it or whatever?
Right. It's just, you know, like a Scotts commercial weed and feed. But but then also the fungal, you know, I'm looking at it, but it's just your basic commercial.
Well, one does one thing and one does another, so it's my general impression you can do it together. But on the fungus, won't that not come around until after the zoysia is actually growing, which is just barely now?
It started last year, and I just sort of wanted to get a jump on it.
Well, you know, fungicides have very short lives. So if you put it on now and wait for the grass, it's going to be long gone by the time you know, your zoysia picks up. So you really ought to wait till the grass is green, and if there's any fungal spores on the grass, then your fungicide will still be active to kill that fungus.
Okay, great. The other thing is, short of getting a lawn chair and a cooler and a shovel, how do I get rid of these voles in my yard?
Oh, well, let me know, because I've got them too. You know what? Cats are good. And they're really hard. And they say to set traps, like put a mouse trap under a flower pot. And so now you got one. Now there's only 1 million left to go. It's really hard. Some people call a fumigator and have their holes are, you know, the ones they travel in are right below the ground, but right. their nests are deep in the ground. So even if you get at the ones that, you know, are right below, you're probably going to have to get someone that can locate the nest and put something stronger down in there to kill the, it's sad, isn't it? But kill's a hard word to say, but yeah. really they are so destructive. People don't realize how.
Oh, they're tearing up my yard. Terrible.
Yeah, they really are. But cats work well. And
right. I'll head down to the Humane Society then.
Okay, then.
Thank you so much for the call. We have an email from Brandon. Says, I would like to grow bamboo in my backyard for privacy. What type of bamboo do you recommend, and how can I contain the bamboo to one area?
Well, whatever you get, you have to make sure that you look it up online, which is easy, and make sure you have a clump bamboo and not a runner. No matter what you might do otherwise, don't inflict a runner bamboo on your neighborhood, because once you do that, in about 3 or 4 years, they're going to all take a vote to ask you to move because you're going to be very unpopular, because there's not a good way to stop running bamboo from running. So for privacy, if you get into bamboo, look for the ones that say clump, and then you'll be all right, because they come all different sizes. So depending on how tall you want it to get, Kurt Blumel, which is a good source for bamboo, and his catalog is online. So look there, and he'll tell you which ones to get.
Now, bamboo is something I normally associate with a tropical climate. That'll grow okay here.
Oh, yeah. We've got a golden groove bamboo. It's all around one of the residences in the garden, and they continually cull those out. And we have a native bamboo. The black mm-hmm. bamboo is a native bamboo.
Yeah.
But you don't want that in a confined place.
Yeah, that's why I love having you here, because I always learn something talking to you guys. Let's back to the phones. We go to Robert in Belleville. Thanks for waiting, Robert. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. I've been gardening for about 20 years, and I've had really good success with most everything except for grapes. And I have a friend, he's had the same problem. You put in a variety that you think will be a good eating variety. And once they get up and producing, you know, they're smaller than they should be. They got a thick skin, very little flavor. And like I said, I have good success with peach trees, apple trees, tomatoes, all that. But it just seems like I've never had any luck with grapes, and I'm getting ready to kind of try it again. But I just don't know what I did wrong the other two times, you know, in the past when I tried it. I was just wondering kind of what recommendations on a particular variety, or, you know, I just don't know what I or this friend of mine, you know, did wrong when we were trying to grow, you know, like good eating type of grapes.
Yeah, grapes are hard. Do you spray anything on your grapes?
No, I never had any type of bug problem. I mean, I had squirrels and birds getting them, but I mean, they didn't have much flavor to it, so after a while I didn't care. But I never had any kind of bug problem or anything like that, you know.
Yeah, I would say it's important to have a spray schedule for your grapes. It's also important to make sure you water them pretty well late in the season as they're starting to put on fruit. It sounds like that might also be a problem with the smaller and the thicker skinned grapes that you have.
Yeah, there's a site. It's Southern Missouri University in Mountain Grove, Missouri, and that's the center where they test fruits and vegetables, and they test grapes, and they have something you can print out that gives you the grape spraying schedule, and it's very specific when you spray whatever you're going to spray. It's not about insects. It's about fungus and development of the fruit as it gets larger and larger. And without doing that, you don't get very much, unfortunately.
By the way, there's a lot of information you can get from the Missouri Botanical Garden website, and we'll have
Absolutely.
A link to that on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I'll also alert folks, I'll be giving you a phone number a little bit later, which that was the Botanical Garden's Horticulture Answer Service. I'll give you a chance to pick up a pencil so you can write that down. But a lot of the questions we're getting today, we may not get to all of them, so you can call that hotline, if you will, and and get the information that you need. Let's go back to the phones and bring in Mike calling from Soulard. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to talk to some knowledgeable folks.
Yes.
I've really enjoyed the conversation about the bees, and I've been concerned about them. I hope everybody is. So we as backyard gardeners, what can we plant to help our bee population sustain or grow?
Oh, great question. Yeah, they love asters. They really like flowers that are purple and yellow for some reason. And so filling your backyard with those colors is a great idea.
Anything in the daisy family, mm-hmm. they really like, because the nectar is in the middle and it's easier for them to get to it. So we're actually at the Kemper Center this year. We're going to have a bee garden. So come down and see what we've got growing, and then you'll see some pretty things that you can grow, too.
Is this... I'll do that. It sounds like it's pretty easy to plant for them.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, very easy.
Is this
okay, thank you very much. I won't take up more of your time.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. Is this something you might recommend for people who obviously have the space? Is a bee garden, if you will, or maybe having a hive or two?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and bee populations can also increase your vegetable productivity, especially if you're trying to grow fruits and like tomatoes mm-hmm. and eggplants and everything. They actually say that bees increase the number of seeds on your strawberries, so you can actually see the strawberries get really? Bigger if there's a large bee presence around.
Well, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Are they hard to take care of?
Honeybees, no. Mm. No, not very hard at all. You have to make sure you feed them in the fall and spring when the honey is low because you've taken some off.
And, what do you feed them?
Sugar water.
Just like a hummingbird?
Yeah, just like a hummingbird. Oh. And then we add some essential oils that help them keep healthy and, yeah.
Okay. I'm sure that's information they can get from the garden as well, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Back to the phones. Evan and Baldwin, go ahead. The word tomato was mentioned a moment ago, and I think he's going to bring it up again. Go ahead, Evan.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll keep it short. I think everybody appreciates tomatoes out of the garden. They taste a lot better than the tomatoes you're probably going to get a lot of other places. And what are some good strategies for getting high yield out of tomato plants in the garden? I've tried using the perimeter, like chicken wire, with PVC piping down to the middle for watering. And I also wonder that versus staking. Does it make any difference with tomato plants? And also, should I be pruning my tomato plants periodically over the season? Because I've had some tomato plants, the plants themselves have been, they've grown noticeably, but then not had a whole lot of yield as far as getting a lot of tomatoes off the plants themselves. So I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll listen to the response off the air, off the phone. I mean, thank you.
Who wants to take that?
Those are all great questions. Yeah, and everyone loves tomatoes. My first suggestion is always with your transplants. You want to make sure you bury most of your tomato plant. The tomato will actually the stem will actually root if you put it below ground, so that'll make sure you have a nice hearty taproot for your tomatoes. And that's just getting started. And then I always think staking is a good idea, especially, I mean, it depends on the variety, but you want to make sure you keep your tomatoes off the ground so no critters or fungus can get to them. And then you also talked about pruning. I would say that if you're seeing a lot of growth and not a lot of fruiting, pruning is a good idea to start thinking about. But they've actually done studies, and they say that pruning throughout the summer isn't necessarily going to increase your yield. It'll increase the size of your fruit. However, at the end of the season, when it starts to get cold, you definitely want to pick out those couple tomatoes that really look like they're going to turn red soon and prune off the rest of the green ones so you make sure you get your last ripe tomatoes.
Speaking of pruning, we have an email from Stacy who writes, I have a rose bush that thinks it's a tree, and I'm wondering if I should prune it down and how I would go about doing that. Do I cut the stems as close to the main stem as possible?
Well, it depends on what the rose is. I mean, if it's a shrub rose and it's just following nature's way, it is going to get big and perhaps out of space. So in that case, you want to wait till after any bloom would have occurred, even if it doesn't have buds this year. But leave it alone now. It's too late to prune it for this year's first set of blooms. But then shorten the stems and try to have the thicker stems horizontal so skinnier stems can arise from that and give you new blooms for a secondary bloom period. If it's a different kind of rose and it's just getting that high, like a hybrid tea, I can't imagine them really getting that high. But again, wait now till it blooms, and then you can cut that back rather severely, and it'll come out again. But it sounds like you're talking maybe about a climber or a shrub rose, and wait again till after it blooms now, and then you can cut it back.
Okay, Stacy. Thank you for your email. Let's bring in Ken calling from St. Louis. Ken, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. Do you have any resources for soaking seeds before planting, and are there any advantages of soaking seeds before planting?
Hmm. Well, a lot of seeds have such a hard seed coat that you have to soften that so it emulates nature and is starting to weaken that seed coat so that the embryo inside can get out. So that's really the function of soaking them. And usually on the seed packet, it usually says if you have to soak the seeds. A lot of them you don't soak any longer than 24 hours or it gets too wet. But if you don't know, then again, look online and just put in seeds you have to soak. And it'll tell you everything you want to know. But usually it's like hyacinth beans or morning glories, something you can look at and just see what a hard coat that is. Or it tells you to abrase it, abuse it. You know, with a file or something, just to, you know, cut that hard coat.
All righty. Well, we thank you for that call. And we're back to tomatoes now with Seth in St. Charles. We always get a lot of tomato calls. Go ahead, Seth, but time is beginning to get away from us.
I'm hoping my question hasn't already been asked. I just tuned in and, hot dog, someone who has an answer. So, like many people, I'm sure my tomatoes got bit a couple weeks ago. I even put bags on top of them. They still got really bit by the frost. I thought they were dead, but my wife went out and looked at them. She said, let's just cut some leaves off. So now I've got tomato plants with maybe 75% of their leaves are gone, but the ones that remained are actually seem kind of viable. And my question is that will they come back? Is just a few, 25% of the leaves still on the plant enough to be able to support the growth of the plant?
They'll definitely be stunted, unfortunately. I would definitely think about maybe getting some new tomatoes or transplanting some more.
Sorry about that. As time winds down, we have another email or two here I think we can get to. Erica asks, is there any way to kill or scare away squash bugs?
Oh, you hire Elizabeth.
Squash bug hunter professional.
Yeah.
One thing that I find really helpful with squash, well, you can cover your squash with row cover, which is very helpful, which you can get from pretty much any garden mm-hmm. supply store. And row cover simply protects the squash from having any squash bugs lay eggs on them. You have to take the row cover off as soon as the plant blooms to provide pollination. Another thing that I do once there is an infestation is continually check for, of course, eggs under the leaves. You can put boards down underneath your squash plants, and the squash bugs will all conglomerate there overnight. And if you lift the board up in the morning, you'll find a good percentage of your squash bug population underneath the boards. So that's a good way to catch them.
That's the way you can deal with them. All right. In the 45 seconds we have left, this has to be quick. It's an email from Natalie. The hedge on one side of my yard completely died last summer, along with a small patch of the adjoining lawn. I'm wondering if this may have to do with the lifespan of a leafy hedge. The hedge on the other side of the lawn is flourishing. Do you have any idea what's going on?
I would suspect it was the drought. Yeah, we see sections of, especially yews, that just died. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, what it means is they're not going to come back. You need to just start over. But since it was the grass and the hedge, I suspect that's what it was, a drought.
Okay, well, the drought did a lot of damage, obviously,
yes,
but we've gotten a lot of water since all of that, so that will be helpful. I want to thank you so much, June Hudson and Elizabeth Spiegel, for being with us. I promised to give the number for the Horticultural Answer Service. That's available Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. till noon. The number is 314 area code, of course, 577-5143. The Horticulture Answer Service at the Missouri Botanical Garden, 314-577-5143. A lot of information on the garden's website. We have a link to it on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Elizabeth and June, thank you once again
thank
so much for being
much.
With us. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about a new collaborative effort to retain more college graduates in the St. Louis region. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.